adverse rulings against trusts of this type.
That's absolutely right, but he was also in possession with other documents that at least could lead somebody to conclude that it was a closer issue than what the jury was told.
But didn't the jury have Parker's testimony that he put his head in the sand and put his fingers in his ears?
Mr. Parker may have put his head in the sand and his fingers in his ears, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone else did. The fact that Mr. Parker saw it that way doesn't mean that everyone else did. These were nuanced judgments that in situations that the individual defendants were precluded from making. Since I'm getting close to the end of my time, I'd like to take a second to address the speedy trial issue.
Oh, boy. I don't know. I'm telling you. You know, you've got three trial judges up here.
I understand. And I knew... let me just say this. First, putting myself in your shoes, I understand that this can make you grit your teeth and go, oh boy.
I'll see you in my heels today.
It would not be a pretty sight. It would not be a pretty sight at all. I don't even make a very good looking guy, much less...
You look great.
Thank you. you know... Those of lawyers, if law is nothing if not rules. Law is nothing if not a series, sometimes rules. I agree to practice law in the Seventh Circuit. I have to agree to do certain things. And those are rules. And sometimes if I violate those rules, there are consequences. There can be consequences to me. There can be consequences to my clients. Judges, when you agree to become district judges, you have to, there are certain rules and certain obligations. And one of the obligations, as troubling as it may be in this context, is to make specific findings with respect to speedy trial and motions for continuance.
But why can't we rely on the sequence of the reasons that you all, the defense, cited for these continuances, coupled with the judge's remarks that agreed with the need for more time to serve as the requisite ends of justice findings. I mean, did any defendant ever object to these continuances?
Not specifically.
Nobody.
No, wait. Specifically, that's an odd word.
No. I mean, no. I'll just say no. There was no objection filed. But that Zedner, number one, says that's not conclusive on the issue. Number two, all of the decisions of the Supreme Court and this court require not findings by inference, but specific findings. At the time the motion was filed and argued, the judge could have simply said, I'm going to make these findings A, B, C, D, E, and F, and that would be the done issue. He never made those findings.
But you have a motion filed on paper. You have an oral argument where defense comes in. Judge, this is a million documents case.
Yes.
We need more time.
Yes.
We cannot go to trial in 2 weeks. We need more time.
Yes.
Government agrees. So not only do you have those allegations and those concerns on paper, but you come in and make an oral record on it. Now, are you saying the judge then has to repeat all of that?
I'm not saying it. I'm saying the decisions of the Supreme Court and this court are saying that, Your Honor.
It could not possibly be.
In the cases we've cited in the brief, and even as...
Not possibly.
Even as...
It might not, Judge Norgo could have possibly done a better job, but my goodness... I'm sorry, Judge McCuskey. Judge Norco.
Yes.
Forgive me. I'm thinking of the next case. But this really, forgive me, Mr. Kimmel, but it really looks like sandbagging a judge.
I understand that's...
It's a little painful.
I understand, and I can appreciate the court's concern. But the fact is, and I appreciate the court's concern, the fact is at no time did he ever make the required findings? And even...
You made them for him.
With respect, the law in this circuit doesn't allow that. If you look at the Adams case, Your Honor, and the Napadal case, which are very, very similar, the court went to some lengths to say that the courts were required to make specific findings, and they couldn't be made sort of pro forma or by inference.
You're going to have to take a look at Napadal, United States versus Napadal. It's our case, 2010, and it holds that we can rely on the sequence of events that culminate in a continuance, including the reasons that are set forth in a party's written motion for a continuation and any additional oral reasons for a continuance that are raised in a hearing at such a motion, coupled with an indication by a court that it was persuaded by those reasons to serve as the requisite findings in support of a court's ends of justice determination. And you also want to look at Adams, which took the same approach. When facts have been presented to the court and the court has acted on them, it is not necessary to articulate those same facts in a continuance order, and that is the law of this circuit.
Well, with respect, and we'll discuss it perhaps on rebuttal, but I see those a little differently. But thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Hine.
May it please the court. Good morning. First of all, just addressing briefly the last issue that you raised, the Speedy Trial Act. It is clear from the record, as I believe Your Honor has noted, that the period from December 7th, 2006 through a new trial date, yet a new trial date in October of 2007, was properly excluded based on the defendant's original motion to continue and then an amended motion to continue, in which they gave great detail as to the various reasons as to why they would not be prepared for trial on February 7th. As Your Honor noted, the judge may have done a better job, but the fact is he actually did make findings. As I said, the defendant's motions themselves specified the reasons why they needed. They said they hadn't completed the review of the digitalized database, that they had several hundred hours of video and audio recordings. They had a substantial number of other documents that they had to review. In their amended motion that they filed on December 4th, just before the hearing on December 7th, 2006, they asserted that they needed more time to complete the review of the material, and they also pointed out that an expert had been recently appointed by the court at their request, a tax and accounting expert that they needed to confer with, and so they needed additional time to gather materials for him, present them to him, and discuss that with him. It was in the context of all those reasons that the defendants had offered that on December 7th, 2006, the judge said, "This is a unique case, and I think all parties agree to that." It's clear that the judge was referring to the complexity of the case, that this was a uniquely complex case. There's simply no other reasonable interpretation of what he said. So he did make a finding there as to the complexity of the case. Also during that hearing, I referred to the judge and told him that Mr. Saltzman, Mr. Hopper's attorney, had told me that this new proposed date in October of 2007 would be a reasonable one that the defense would be prepared for. And the judge, in response to that, said that an October date would appear to be a realistic date, again referring to the defense's claim that they needed to be given much more time in order to be adequately prepared for this uniquely complex case. Again, although these findings may not have been as elaborate, he didn't cite chapter and verse each provision of the Speedy Trial Act. Given the circumstances under Napadal and Adams, it's clear that these findings that the court made are sufficient And there's really no Speedy Trial Act issue
so
here.
So what was really missing were just the magic words and the interests and the ends of justice. I mean, even if that finding wasn't made. And
that's true.
Was no suggestion made by the government to use those magic words, because we might not be here if those magic words had been used.
At the December 7th, 2006 hearing, those words were not used at all. That's true. However, at the hearing on February 15th, 2008, on the Speedy Trial Act motion that had been filed just 2 days before that, the government did say that the hearing at the motion. It was still pre-trial, and the government did say that, you know, Your Honor already excluded all this time in the interest of justice because of the complexity of the case and the need for them to prepare for trial. And the judge manifested agreement with that. He said, okay. And then he asked the defense, you know, what's your reply? They had no adequate reply for that. And he subsequently denied the motion.
Would it be sufficient just for the court to find that it was a complex case and then in the interest of justice, continuance? Would that be sufficient?
There was a complex case?
Just a simple, I find it's a complex case based upon the representations of the parties. Is that sufficient finding?
It might well be. I mean, that's one of the factors that's set forth in the Speedy Trial Act provision for an interest of justice.
Uh-huh. And I although mean, the judge didn't use complex here, he used unique, but I'm assuming...
He said unique, but there's no question. Again, given all the circumstances that led up to this hearing, all the representations that the defendants had made as to just how complex it was. And there's no question, it was an incredibly complex case with a huge volume of documents and hundreds of hours of tapes and things that they needed, to both audio and video, that they needed to review. Mm-hmm. The judge was proper in finding that this was a unique case, mm-hmm. and that they did need this time and that time should be excluded.
And then, of course, another way to exclude is with pretrial motions. And here, it appears that there were several pretrial motions, but some of them were two years old. And that doesn't appear to me to be resolved with reasonable promptness, as called for.
That's true.
Why were these motions pending 2 years? Do you have any idea?
I can't speak for the court judge. Other than that, this case was continued a number of times.
Right.
There were literally dozens and dozens of motions being filed at different points in time. And for whatever reason, the judge ruled on the ones that were most urgent, I guess, at the time. But when the case got kicked another 8 months or a year, perhaps he didn't. But, I mean, the government's main argument really doesn't rely on these motions. It's very complicated. It's hard to sort out, really, what was pending at what time and you know, just, you know, when time should be excluded for this motion or that motion. But as you point out, that is another basis for it. And there were at different periods of time motions pending for long periods of time, as well as other motions that were pending for much shorter periods of time. If you don't have any other questions...
I'm just thinking about the future in this kind of thing, because, again, if the magic words had been said, I understand the court just said yes and nobody opposed it, but... I mean, it's a pretty easy thing for the government to say, and so will the court make the finding that this is a complex case and in the interest of justice it should be excluded. And then in terms of keeping track of the motions, just someone should be keeping track of the motions. I understand that's the court's responsibility and the court's clerk, but you can't even tell us now how the – and I understand you're not here prepared to argue how the motions were filed, as Judge Young was asking you that question, but somebody should be keeping an eye on.
That's true.
And keeping track of it so we have a clean record. Then these don't even become issues.
That's right. But in this case, again, the judge wasn't relying just on the complexity of the case. I mean, he was also relying on the defendant's representation.
I totally get that. But to me, the record is here to justify that unique and the fact that the missing words aren't there. I mean, when you look at the documents and everything you said, it's clear it's a complex case. But
I wish those words were there too, but I don't think Napadal requires those, Judge.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't require. I'm just talking about a practical standpoint. It's a way that you don't have to. But I know the case law doesn't require it. I'm not saying it does.
Sure.
It's just a practical, easy way to avoid the issue.
Sure. Okay. Then I'd like to next address the issue about this notice to all.
I'd like you to address that
notice to one
all ARDC thing.
Oh, okay.
Mary Robinson sitting there and reading the hearing transcript or whatever she was doing.
Actually, she
would have thought she would have known better.
No, Judge. Actually, what she was doing was reading portions of the complaint that the ARDC had filed, in which the ARDC had made it very clear that Mr. Bartoli, who was then an attorney at the time, was committing fraud.
Yeah, but have you ever heard of anything like that before?
I haven't, but I certainly don't.
I don't think any of us have. I mean, that was very unusual.
But she was publishing an exhibit that was in evidence that was properly admitted as notice evidence to the defendants. There was evidence, first of all, that this evidence applied not just to Mr. Bartoli.
All right, so you tell me why it was appropriate for the woman who once upon a time ran the ARDC to read from the testimony of the ARDC proceeding, given that none of the defendants were there. Give me a rationale for what went on.
There was ample evidence that the defendants had notice of both the ARDC complaint as well as the deposition of Mr. Moretzky, who is the expert for the ARDC, who testified about the tax effects of this Aegis Trust scheme. For example, the ARDC complaint, again, was one of the things that was found at the offices of the Aegis headquarters, where five of the six men worked. Another copy of the complaint was also found at Sean Dunn's office. There was testimony by Mr. Parker that Mr. Dunn had sent to Mr. Parker, who lived in New York, a copy of the ARDC complaint. Mr. Parker further testified that he prepared an analysis of the ARDC complaint, and he sent it back to Mr. Dunn and Mr. Vallone and the other defendants, not all six of them, but he named other defendants.
So did they also have a copy of Marutsky's
The deposition?
For the ARDC?
Yes, Judge. In fact, not only was a copy of the deposition testimony found at the Aegis headquarters during the search, but on one of the computers, there was also found an analysis that had been prepared by Robert Hopper, one of the defendants, of that deposition testimony. There couldn't be clearer evidence that he had notice of that particular testimony by Mr. Moretzky that this was an illegal scheme.
But wasn't the testimony at the hearing presented at the trial? And not just the complaint.
Right.
But there was testimony at the of the hearing presented in which none of the defendants were present.
I don't know that's true, that testimony of the, I mean, other than what I've just described as far as the complaint and the
testimony. She read from, unless I'm really off the wall, she read from
my
the
understanding
testimony.
Is that she read from the testimony, but could be
from the deposition testimony, but from no other parts of the proceedings. And again, as I'm saying, that deposition testimony was in fact
introduced at the hearing. The deposition testimony,
yes,
would have been, right?
Yes, it was.
Well, therefore, you have
okay. I'm sorry. I guess I misunderstood. There wasn't anything else other than as far as the whole proceeding. It wasn't presented to the to the jury. It just the portions that were found on the Aegis premises or on Mr. Dunn's premises, or that we had evidence of Mr. Hopper analyzing and critiquing, and of the other defendants being notified about concerning Mr. Parker's review of it. In addition to that, one other point, I guess, to be made about the ARDC complaint and the ARDC proceedings in general is four of the defendants, after the ARDC complaint was filed in 1996, alleging fraud by Mr. Bartoli for basically carrying out the Aegis scheme, four of the defendants, Mr. Dunn, Mr. Hopper, Mr. Vallone, and Mr. Bartoli, brought a lawsuit, this lawsuit against the ARDC, in which they claimed, they claimed a number of different things, but they responded to this complaint, obviously showing they received this complaint, by filing a lawsuit against the ARDC. Further notice evidence that we had in this case was the fact that the lawsuit that they brought was brought here in this district court here in the Northern District of Illinois in front of Judge Plunkett. And Judge Plunkett dismissed the case as frivolous. And in fact, in November of 1999, he sanctioned the four defendants for bringing the frivolous action and stated very clearly that they may wish that this system were a lawful means of minimizing taxes, but it is not. You can hardly imagine clearer evidence to the defendants than a district court judge telling them this is not legal.
Could we go on to the ostrich instruction? Because I'd like you to answer this. Is there a conflict between the Cheek defense and the ostrich instruction? In other words, how does a jury go about reconciling the concept of conscience avoidance with a good faith misunderstanding of tax law?
Judge, I don't think there is a conflict. The Cheek instruction, which was our instruction number 24, basically told the jury that the defendants had to act willfully, and they defined that as being in violation of a known legal duty. The ostrich instruction simply helped the jury understand what knowledge or knowingly can mean.
It was instruction number 25, but it doesn't matter.
The Cheek instruction was 24 and ostrich was 25. I may have misspoke. But I don't see that one negates the other. I think the one says you have to act willfully in violation of a known legal duty. The other says, well, here's what knowingly means or what knowledge means. It doesn't preclude the Cheek defense at all.
Speaking with the jury instructions, why wasn't an instruction about what was law and what was simply an IRS opinion proper? If something is not law, doesn't it go to the validity or help to support the defendant's subjective beliefs?
Judge, I believe you're referring to their proposed
exactly.
instruction relating to IRS Notice 9724.
Right.
That was properly rejected by the court. The jury,
as stated, though I understand it was rejected, but
right, and I'm arguing that it was proper to do so because the jury was not left with the impression at any point that this notice was an authoritative statement of the law. First of all, the government never argued that this notice had the force of law. I mean, there's, as I said, there's all sorts of notice evidence in this case. I mean, and that notice 9724 from the IRS was one form of it. I mean, we also had the district court telling them this is wrong, the ARDC, an arm of the Illinois Supreme Court, saying that this is wrong. We had the tax court and the Muich decision saying this is wrong. We also had dozens of letters that began coming into the AGIS offices and to Dunn's office as well, starting in 1994, from tax professors, from accountants, from lawyers, saying what I've been contacted by someone who's considering investing or getting involved with this. This is clearly wrong, and we never argued that sort of evidence had the force of law. Just like we didn't argue that this 9724 had the force of law. In fact, as far, again going back to 9724 specifically, an IRS agent on cross-examination was asked about this, and he said this simply expresses the IRS's opinion of the law. That was Agent Paul Ponzo, and it was at page 45, 80, and 81 of the transcript. At least one of the defense attorneys, I think Mr. Schindler, if not others, argued in closing that this notice did not have the force of law. As I said, the government never argued that either. There was no question about it. There was no reason for an instruction to try and clarify this.
What would have been the harm, then, of giving it? I mean, just a little more information to the jury to clarify.
In this case, we felt it was unnecessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't. There was no controversy. I mean, about it one way or the other.
In your mind.
I'm sorry.
In your mind.
In our mind. And again, you know, when you look at the jury instructions as a whole, I think they adequately. Explain.
Which you do. You have to look at them as a whole.
Absolutely. And when you do that, I think the exclusion of that, I mean, even if it could have been added, the exclusion of that does not make the whole instructions as a whole insufficient or deficient in any substantial way.
But you agree it's slightly different than all those other types of evidence when people were saying it's not valid, it's not true. I mean, the fact that it was an IRS reg, you just don't think it was necessary.
But it wasn't a reg, just to be particular. It was a notice.
A notice.
Right. Exactly. But you know what? The defendants themselves, in dealing with that, Mr. Vallone prepared a big response to Notice 9724. And you know, he himself had pointed out that was not, the law or an authoritative statement of law. I mean, again, there was really no question in the record. There was no dispute by any of the evidence to indicate that was considered by the government to be an authoritative statement of law, or by the defense for that matter.
Mr. Hines, can you tell me, what was the evidence that Mr. Dowd was present on that cruise where Mr. Eisen talked about the obligation to report on the purchase made with the credit cards that were linked to those foreign trusts?
Now, it's interesting you raise that, because the defense erroneously in a reply brief says that there's no evidence that he was there. In fact, there were two forms of evidence, Judge, that showed very clearly that Mr. Dowd was there. One of the exhibits offered into evidence was the cruise manifest listing all the people who were there. Michael Dowd is one of the people listed there. Moreover, in one of the I should point out that Mr. Eisen's presentation on the cruise was videotaped. And portions of that of his speech to the group there were presented as evidence. And on one of the portions that was offered into evidence and presented to the jury, Mr. Eisen directly addressed Michael Dowd. He says, "Dowd, what's the pig theory?" And I don't know if Michael Dowd understood what he meant by that, but he actually gave some response about the pig theory. I don't know if Eisen was thinking about pigs and hogs and the distinction between them or what. I really don't know. But he actually did, in fact, address Dowd during his presentation. So the statement that there's no evidence that Mr. Dowd was on this cruise is absolutely false.
Was Dr. Goldstein independent expert or the government's expert? You know, Mr. Bartoli's attorney insists that he was your expert.
Yes, he does at this point on appeal. He didn't at the time, though.
In other words, the government maintains that was an agreed-upon expert.
There's no question it was an agreed-upon expert, Judge. In fact, a document filed with this court said that the parties agreed that Dr. Goldstein would examine him. Just to back up procedurally, what happened is when the issue of Mr. Bartoli's competence first came up. On December 14, 2007, the district court entered an order directing that Bartoli be sent to the Bureau of Prisons facility in Springfield, Missouri, to be examined there by a doctor that we had contacted, we, the government, had contacted, a Dr. Denny, who said that he could examine him. There was no question at that point that, we felt Dr. Denny was a government expert. And at that time, on at that hearing on December 14th, the judge said, well, if Dr. Denny's report favors the government, then Bartoli can select another expert of his own for a second examination. But the facts changed completely shortly after that. Bartoli filed an appeal with this court, the Court of Appeals, from the judge's order on December 14th, and the parties resolved that appeal. It was never heard. It was dismissed upon the filing of an agreed motion for voluntary dismissal. It was docket number 9 in that case, and it was signed by both government counsel and by Bartoli's attorney. And that motion stated in part, the parties have conferred and have now agreed to have defendant examined for competency on January 29th and 30th, 2008, by Diana S. Goldstein at the Isaac Ray Center. So the parties did, in fact, agree, rather than having a government expert and then possibly a second defense expert look, the parties agreed to have Dr. Goldstein examine Mr. Bartoli here in Chicago, not in custody at the Bureau of Prisons facility in Springfield, but here.
And how do you respond to Mr. Bartoli's point that he and his counsel never had adequate time to review Dr. Goldstein's report in order, you know, to demonstrate that either they needed a second expert or that a competency hearing was absolutely necessary?